Welcome to Radio Adishanti, and I'm Adya. And I want to welcome everyone from, well, literally all around the world who listen to this program and tune in and write me emails and send me letters about what they're getting from this program. So I want to make sure that everyone feels welcome wherever you might be. Here on the west coast of California at 6 o'clock, at other places it could be the middle of the night. For some people it's early in the morning, and others it's late in the evening. So for wherever you are, welcome to this program, to this really what we create each time we meet together like this, is a virtual sangha, a virtual spiritual community, you might say. And this program is really dedicated to exploring the deepest truth within our being, within existence. And that's really what I'm here for. That's what my teaching is dedicated to, and that's what I encourage for everybody who might tune in to take a moment to put aside the trivialities of life, put aside the small things, you might say, for a few moments, and really, really look deeply into the nature of our own existence, into the nature of that which is sacred and timeless and whole. In other words, spirituality is really a means that we address the deepest yearning that's really in the heart of all beings, whether they think of themselves as spiritual or not. Really, all beings in their own unique ways yearn for peace, for happiness, yearn for home, yearn for a deep sense of connectedness. And that's what we're here for. That's what this program is for. For those who may be listening for the first time, I want to remind you that this is a call-in program, so you can call in, and the numbers are on your screen, but please wait until I open the phone lines. I'll tell you a little later in the program when they open up. If you call too soon, they just won't be answered. So just wait, and I'll let you know when we open the phone lines up, and I welcome your questions. I wanted to start out this evening. It's really sort of a response to one of the emails I got. I won't read the particular question, but I wanted to respond to it in a way, and I thought to open the program this evening, this might be a good place to start. And really, it's sort of a very, very brief, you might say, very brief summary of what the spiritual movement is. You could call it the spiritual path, but I like to think of it more like an internal movement inside yourself, more than a path that one pursues and hopes to arrive somewhere at some point in time. And we all start, in one sense, in this path, in the visible world around us, the world of manifestation, what we take in through our five senses. And one of the metaphors I like to use, or images that I find helpful, is the image of a tree. And the whole manifest world are just the leaves on the tree. It's the exterior view that our senses pick up. And then there's the branches, and the branches are really our senses themselves, our sense of sight and sound and taste and touch. And our senses are what register this world around us, or what take it in. It's these senses are that which life or consciousness uses to sense itself, to contact with the visible world. And so in many spiritual traditions, actually, one's taught how to use their senses. In other words, to pay attention to your sense of sight and sound and taste and touch and feeling. Many of the spiritual practices are various ways of utilizing your senses. And really, one of the reasons for this is to simply get us out of our minds, to get us out of our obsession with thinking and imagination. And one of the quickest ways to do that is to connect with your senses, what your senses take in. Now, our senses also arise out of consciousness. And in this metaphor of this tree, consciousness would be likened to the trunk of the tree. So consciousness is that which recognizes what comes in from the senses and also recognizes what doesn't come in from the senses too. We can talk about that a little later. But consciousness is that awareness that takes everything in, that notices everything, every experience that ever happens. It's taken in through the senses and recognized by consciousness itself. So in this moment, as we're together, your sense of hearing is taking in my voice right now. For those of you who've are utilizing the video feed, then you also can see me at this moment and your sense of sight. But senses without consciousness wouldn't mean much. So consciousness is sort of the trunk of this tree of existence. And at the very, very root of existence is what I call the primordial void. The primordial void isn't something that can be easily described, actually, because it's beyond all description. The closest that I ever come to describing it is just to call it a sort of pure potential. A pure potential before any of that potential has been realized, has been made manifest. And in that sense, it's void because absolutely nothing has arisen from it. And really the process of our coming back to ourselves, coming back home, our spiritual awakening is coming back to the root of existence, coming from the manifest world back through the gate of the senses into consciousness. And when we come into consciousness deeply, then that consciousness, its natural capacity for self-recognition, it recognizes itself. That capacity it has becomes realized. And when the capacity consciousness has to recognize itself to become realized, then that's a moment of spiritual awakening, in a sense. It's a shift in consciousness. Actually, it's a shift away from what consciousness takes in through the senses to consciousness itself. So consciousness recognizes itself. You could also say spirit. Spirit recognizes itself. And that's one level of spiritual awakening. And ultimately, one even goes deeper than that to this primordial void, to the root from which existence comes, the first manifestation of existence being consciousness. And when we come back to our real deepest, ultimate nature, the ultimate reality of what we are, of what everything is, it's really, this is something that's, in a sense, beyond consciousness. It is the root of existence. It's this primordial void. And, of course, in spirituality, as I often like to explain it, it's really a backward step. It's a step from appearances, whether it's appearance in what we see, taste, touch, and feel around us, or it's the appearance inside, primarily in our minds, because those are appearances too, what we think, what we imagine, the conclusions we make. And coming back from those conclusions, coming back from the world of appearances, stepping back into yourself, and then you step back into yourself through your senses, through paying attention to your senses, and then you notice, then you come back to this consciousness, which is the consciousness that's functioning through the senses, that's conscious of the senses, back to the primordial void. But spirituality isn't simply a process of taking the backward step of a return. Once we've fully returned, then the process of going back out ensues again, but it happens from a conscious way. So the primordial void births itself as consciousness into this, and then the senses, and then the perceived world. Once we've returned to the void in a very conscious way, then we can actually accomplish this return, this natural and spontaneous return to the world, as it were, without getting lost, without getting overly identified in what consciousness is conscious of and identified with what the senses pick up. Because all human beings have the experience of being born, having senses, having consciousness, and then bit by bit by bit we start to become identified with what we imagine, what we think, who we think we are, what we think we are, what we're told about ourselves, what we're told about the world and God and all the rest. We become identified with that, and then we seek home again. We seek some deep existential resolution. And so, as I said, spirituality is in one sense primarily a return, but it's not a return where you stay, but it's a return back to the primordial void, and then from the primordial void back into the world. And ultimately, these two are kind of like breathing. Both are happening simultaneously, this return in to the void and this return from the void back to the world that's perceived by our senses. And this is sort of a very, very quick, rudimentary way of looking at the spiritual journey, you could say. But I often find that to make spiritual teachings simple actually makes them powerful. If it's very, very complex, it may seem very enticing, very interesting, but it's often not very powerful. So I like to present these teachings as a simple way as I can, because then they have a power. Then each person is invited to look within themselves and find out what they mean for themselves. So you undertake them and you find out what they mean for you. But this comes out of a question where someone was talking about the void. And one of the things I think is really, really quite necessary to understand is, again, the idea is not to return simply back to consciousness and then to the primordial void as an end point. Primordial void or consciousness, even, it's neither one of them are end points. It's not a place we stay and set up camp and create a whole new sort of identity around and hold on, because if you do, you find that you start not functioning so well in the world, because you literally retrieve your life force from the world around you and also ultimately from your own body and mind. And if you retreat enough, then it becomes very difficult for life to live through you in a wise and balanced way. But when you come back to your root of the primordial void, and then it naturally and spontaneously starts to return. The void moves out into consciousness, the senses, and then the world that we perceive around us. Once this sort of circle happens, then we've found the truth of who we are, both essentially and relatively, and life can continue this sort of circular, unified expression that it has of return in and return back out. And like I said, it becomes like breathing. Now, of course, for many, many people, the return back to their real essence itself has its own challenges. And that's where I find so many people are actually to this day. A lot, even people who've awakened, many of them, probably most of them, have awakened as consciousness itself, which is amazing and very, very profound. And yet if you try to hold on to that, two things happen. If you try to hold on to that and think that that's simply an end point, then number one, you don't really fully allow yourself to return to the void. And also, you don't allow the void to fully return back into life. So wherever we stop, we tend to get stuck. And to me, spirituality is primarily about unstucking oneself, getting yourself so you're not stuck, so you're not fixated. You're not fixated in the outside world. You're not fixated in your mind and what you think and what you imagine and what you believe. And you're not fixated on inner experiences of emptiness or even the primordial void, that you're really a free being is a freeing that's not stuck on any level of existence. But they're actually freed up. All these are freed up so that they kind of flow as a unified whole. Because when I talk about these, it's as if they're different things. But it's why I like to use the image of a tree, because a tree is one thing. The leaves, the branches, the trunk, the roots. It's one. They all go together to make one tree. You can't actually take one to the exclusion of the other. There isn't roots that are totally separate from a trunk or a trunk that's totally separate from branches and so on. It's actually a unified whole, even though when it's described it might seem like very distinct and different things. But the more I go around and teach and the more people I talk to, I find that really there's those who are really in the process of awakening to themselves as this consciousness. Sometimes there's those who've awoken to this primordial void. And then there's also those who've gone that deep and are now, their next phase is actually to come back out of even attachment to that void or attachment to consciousness and let this existence flow back out in its sort of an overflow of life experiencing itself. And in that, there's really nowhere to get stuck. There's nothing to grasp hold of. There's nothing to hide behind. But there's one aspect of this that I want to also touch upon this evening. And that is something that I find very, very important, and is that it's really useful to look at it, where your attention is rooted, what it roots itself in, which means what is it, not only what does it attach to, but literally where is it living most of the time? And really a lot of spirituality is rooting our experience back to its source. So ultimately all experience gets rooted back first into consciousness. And by rooted, I mean you tracing experience back to its source. So if there's a thought, you trace the thought from where it came. And when you trace a thought back to where it came, it comes from from consciousness, from a totally thoughtless, awake space. And when you trace consciousness back to its source, its source is this primordial void. But initially, spirituality is all about tracing back what we take in through our senses back into consciousness, to really root experience into consciousness, root thought into consciousness, root experience, root feeling, emotion. If our experience is not rooted within consciousness and then ultimately in the void, what ends up, you end up very top-heavy, very topsy-turvy. So if you have a thought, immediately your consciousness identifies with the thought. It gets carried away with the thought in a trance state or a feeling that you have or an experience or the outside world, you know. Consciousness just gets completely lost. It loses its root. And, of course, as soon as consciousness has lost its root or its source, it will feel this yearning, this quite natural yearning to come back to its source, to stay connected, in other words. And this is what it means to sort of root one's experience back into consciousness, back into this conscious, awake stillness. And once that helps one to awaken. And then even that consciousness, you find it's also rooted into this sort of primordial void. Sometimes it may be called the Godhead, the primordial void almost into non-existence, you might say. Hard to find a word for the primordial void, but that's what I call it. And when all of your experience becomes rooted in the void, then whatever happens doesn't keep all of your attention, doesn't just get lost in the next thought that comes up, in the next belief pattern, in the next assumption. It stays rooted, even though you're connecting with the world, you're connecting even with the world of thought and ideas and all of that that we all use in our day-to-day lives to operate, that life uses to operate. But we do so in such a way that we spontaneously stay connected to that our source, that which is unmoving, unborn, and undying. And only that root, the root of existence, which is unborn, undying, and uncreated, knows that everything in creation, everything we see, taste, touch, and feel is an expression of the unexpressible void. Only from that depth of experience do we know that everything, literally everything, is an expression of that pure potential, of that primordial void. And so naturally there's a rootedness. By rooting, I also mean if you know, like a sailboat has ballast, it has this deep weight that is in the ballast of the boat. It runs in the center of the boat, usually underneath the level of the water, and it keeps the boat from toppling over when a wind hits it. If it didn't have any deep centered weight, a wind would just come, grab the sail, and could literally just knock the boat over. So there's this ballast, there's weight in the center of most any ocean-going vessel that helps it to remain straight, to not get tipped over. And spiritually speaking, to root experience back into consciousness and then consciousness in the void gives you sort of this ballast, this way in which you don't get just taken away or pushed over by the next experience, that you always stay connected with the source, with the essence of your being. And this is something that even for people who have had deep awakenings, it doesn't necessarily mean in and of itself that they are able just to stay rooted in it. And many people find that their awakening, the moments of clarity kind of come and go and are sometimes dependent on what they think, what they feel, the situations in their life, etc. But the more rooted we become within consciousness, and again, how one becomes rooted is to trace each experience that comes in from the senses to its source. So each thought gets traced back into the thoughtless. Each sound gets traced back into silence. Each taste gets followed backwards into that which is not a taste, and so on. And by doing that, you really kind of create this rooted ability to stay very awake, to stay in a very, very clear space, regardless of what may be happening around you. And at some point, this happens naturally. Of course, we all are essentially already rooted into existence. I mean, everything that I'm talking about is already happening. It's just what you're really doing is becoming more and more aware of it, more cognizant of it. You're bringing more awareness to it. And that makes all the difference, because something may be functioning, but if you don't know it's functioning, if there's no awareness of it, then it's as if it's not functioning. So it's very useful to be conscious of what's happening. And when all your experience gets rooted into consciousness, into that inner stillness and silence, and then stillness gets rooted into this primordial void, then you'll find this great inner spiritual stability. And then when once it's rooted, then there's a flowing back out. In the Zen tradition, one of the images that's used to depict the fully enlightened sage is the sage is walking back off the mountaintop, symbolizing enlightenment, walking back off the mountaintop with a staff in his hand and a bag of goodies over his shoulder, and he's walking right back into the world. And this is really what I'm talking about, whereas our deepest, truest nature isn't trying to hide in consciousness or in this sort of primordial void, but eventually it has this return back to life, back to existence, back to the fullness of what it means to be alive. And except now it's done in a conscious way, which makes all the difference in the world, to really come back into life, into a full engagement with life in a conscious way makes all the difference. It's the difference between freedom and peace and happiness and its opposite, suffering, confusion, all the various ways we can be in suffering and confused. So I wanted to just start the program out with that very, very brief idea, but if you really put some of it to practical use, if you actually really do trace a thought into the thoughtless and trace a feeling into that which isn't a feeling and trace your and to notice that everything you see with your through your eyes, everything you see is actually being seen by a consciousness that you can't see. And by bringing awareness to that, by noticing it, you're actually rooting your experience back to its source, into a depth. And by doing that, you actually, number one, you can awaken to what you are, and you can also become very deeply rooted in your own essence, in your own source, so that the next thing that comes along in life just doesn't knock you off balance all the time. Let's see. I think I'll go ahead and open the phone lines up. Let me just remind you, the numbers for U.S. and Canada is 800-997-7182, 900-997-7182, and the international line is 408-938-0476, 408-938-0476. So if you do have a question, please do give me a call. And keep in mind that what this program is really dedicated to the really deep, deep questions of existence of our really deep inner lives. It's not just for the questions aren't just sort of off the top of your head questions of mere interest. Those aren't really the questions that I'm really interested in talking about, to be quite honest. But the questions that really touch to the deepest, most essential part of your existence, to that which is the most meaningful. In other words, the deepest question within you. That's really what this program is for, is to open a space for that. And it takes a few minutes for the lines to get up, for people to call, and for them to get on my computer screen so I can see who's calling. So while that happens, I think I might just go to an email question or two. There were two questions on the subject, at least two questions, actually, on the subject of death. And I'm going to choose one of them because I thought it was representative of some of the other ones. And I'll just read this to you. And this is from Brant. And Brant says, "Hi, Ajay. One of my relatives just passed, and I find myself a bit lost. I understand that awakening doesn't mean you don't feel grief and sadness. On the contrary, if anything, it's more genuine. In many ways, death is the spiritual elephant in the living room. The thing we all know is coming to everyone, yet isn't talked about much, including in mindfulness circles." And I take it that Grant has traveled within the mindfulness kind of circles and spirituality. "I'm not talking about what happens to people after death. I'm not talking about how one approaches death. Pardon me. I'm talking about how one approaches death mindfully, either when one loses a loved one or if one is approaching death themselves. I realize this is a big topic, but could you speak a bit about this, please?" And of course, death is a big topic. Death is the only certain thing about life, about being born, is dying. It's the one thing you can know that you will experience, that will happen with certainty, is death. And try as one might to avoid it, to not talk about it, to not explore it. There it is. It's the, as Brent says, it is the elephant, the pink elephant in the closet or in the living room that everybody knows is there, and yet most people are trying very, very hard to ignore. And of course, Brent's experience here is, you know, when someone else dies, someone you love, someone you care about dies, that can bring up grief and sadness. Because if we really know, even if we have a real deep knowing of the immortality of life, because life itself is something that is immortal, actually. What I mean by that, there's really no more or less of life ever. Because death happens doesn't mean there's less of life. However, when someone dies that we know, that we love, that we care about, there is a loss. The death is no longer taking, or life is no longer taking that form, the form of the person that we loved. It's taking a different form now. And what we experience, the dissolution of form, the dissolving of form, that's what we call death. And we can love the form that someone took. We can love being able to be with them and talk to them and interact with them. And then death comes along and all of a sudden that form is no longer there. And that can, of course, bring some sadness and some grief. And yet it's also of great, great comfort when we really know, when we know the essence of existence, when we know what we are, when we know what each other really is, we know that our essence, our deepest, deepest substance is not something that comes and goes. It's not something that's ever born, and it's not something that dies. And yet within that, birth and life and death happen. And this death is this amazing mystery. It's as mysterious as life, and maybe more so. And in most spiritual circles, of course, there's some attempt to deal with this pink elephant in the closet that people are trying to pretend isn't there. And certainly, in any approach to real spiritual awakening, coming to a reckoning with death is vitally important. First of all, there is a death at the end of our biological lives where the body will no longer, the life force will recede out of the body and it will disperse itself back into life as a whole, back into existence. And that's certainly something that every being is going to experience. There's also the death day to day of little deaths here and there, the death of wanting something and not being able to get it, the death of what we thought we would become, who we hoped to be. And there's many, many little small deaths in life. There's even deaths within spirituality and some very important ones. Of course, the age-old teaching to die before you die so that you can fully live. So that we die, to who we imagined ourselves to be. And that is a type of death, to really allow to die what we imagine to be. And not only what we imagine to be, but what we imagine life to be, what we have imagined this existence to be. When we really question it and meditate upon it, what we come to see is most of our perceptions are completely colored by our inner beliefs and our inner assumptions. And when we begin to see through those, that perception disappears. It dies. And the person we thought we were also dies. And this is really a spiritual death. It's an invitation to die before you physically die so that you can actually live. And this inner sort of death of our illusions is really the hallmark of what spirituality is all about. We must die to what we imagined to be so, who we imagined ourselves to be, what we imagined the world to be, what we imagined God to be. That must die in order for us to come into realization, a clarity of what's really real and true and whole. So we confront death on many, many different levels. And I think Brandt's right here that, you know, most human beings are not actually really paying attention to the death, not only at the end of biological lives, but also the deaths day to day, the invitations to really let go and let what causes suffering to die. Let what causes suffering to die, because so many human beings cling to the very things that cause them to suffer. And they cling to them because if they let, number one is they cling to them out of misunderstanding, out of being ignorant, that they're clinging to something that they really think is real, and so they cling on very hard. But also we cling on to illusion because if we let our illusions go, it would be a kind of death. It is a kind of death. We don't really know what we are then. We don't really know what life is when we let go of our ideas and our illusions. Of course, there is something to be realized there. There is a whole true life, real life, is waiting for all of us. But it happens through this doorway of a death, to die before you die, so you can truly live. Of course, if and when we die, before we die, then when we have our biological death, then our biological death can happen without fear, because we know that we're not limited to our biological vehicles. We know that, and we don't just believe it. If you've really had really deeply returned to the source of your own being, you know that. It's not a matter of belief. It's not a matter of imagination. It's as obvious as, well, more obvious than anything else in life, actually. And that also has a deep impact when somebody you know, somebody you cherish, somebody you love, passes away. It's a very different experience inside when someone passes away that you know that there's never more or less of life, that what that person really was in their essence has not actually changed. What they were in their essence was always unborn and undying and unchanging. And when we know that within ourselves, we know that within each other. And that has a profound effect of how easy it is. It helps it to be much easier to be able to let go, because we realize what we're letting go of is the form. That's what we're letting go of. We're not imagining then that someone has actually essentially in their essence passed away, died, because there is no such thing as death to the essence. It's to the appearance. And that makes a great amount of difference. So death is an integral part of life. Death is not the end of life. That's the way we've been taught. That's the illusion we've been taught. There's this thing called birth and then life, and then at the end of life there's this thing called death when there is no more life. That's what we're taught. But really, if you really look into yourself, look into the nature of existence, you'll find that this isn't true. Death is an integral part of the process of life. Life comes together and is always going back into disillusionment. It's dissolving itself. It comes up into a form temporarily, and then it goes out, like breathing in and breathing out. When it lets go of the form that it created, there's not less of life. Life is not disappearing. Life is not going anywhere. It's just going back into a formless aspect. It'll come back into form again. It's like breathing in and breathing out. So life and death really aren't separate. They're not even opposite. They're really one aspect. There is no life without death, and there is no death without life. And what's beyond life and death, this world of appearances, of course, is consciousness. Life, death, this very moment, is something that happens within consciousness. All of existence happens within consciousness. And consciousness happens within the primordial void. And that one has to experience. Even though it is beyond all experience, there's really no clearer way to say it. You can only know the primordial void by being it. It's an absolute mystery. It's an absolute, undefinable, unapproachable, unexplainable mystery. And yet, death is a real wonderful teacher to us. Sometimes it's a fierce teacher, because sometimes death really, in its own way, forces us to really look into life, into our own existence, into what life's all about. And in that sense, death can be a really fierce teacher. It's a way that life says, look, look deeply, look, wake up. Utilize this moment to really look at yourself, to look at the essence of existence. It's a very, very profound and deep and, as I said many times, fierce opportunity, a fierce teaching. And yet, it's also such an integral part of this existence that when we stop shying away from it and actually receive what it's trying to show us, what death is trying to show us is our own immortality. That's what it's trying to show us our own deathless nature, our unborn, undying, uncreated nature. That's what death is there to show us. But as Brent wrote in his email, so often we shy away from it. And in shying away from it, we actually shy away from, in many ways, our greatest opportunity to really awaken to the essence of what we are. And by embracing it, by opening to the mystery of what death is, it really opens the doorway to reality in many ways. So I want to thank Brent for that email. Let's go to the phones. Let's see who do I have here. Let's go to Patricia in Indiana. Welcome to the program, Patricia.
Hi, Adya.
Hi.
Wow. I was going to try to call on this topic, and you opened with the topic.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
I'll be darned.
And after the huge experience 3 years ago, you were the only person that explained or suggested how I should proceed from that experience.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Much gratitude.
No, thank you.
The practice, which isn't really... Oh, I can see you now.
Oh.
The practice, which is no longer a practice,
yeah,
really, resting as awareness, the experience, there was a vast, tangible presence.
Yes.
Very tangible, that has never left.
Yeah.
And resting in awareness is that.
Yes.
But the void experience,
mm-hmm,
if you want to call it an experience.
Yeah, it's hard to even talk about it, isn't it?
There was no me there.
Right.
There was no consciousness there.
Yes.
And that's source.
Yes. Yes.
I know that.
Yes. There's no identity there at all.
No, mm-hmm, it's nothing. Except, like you said, the creative, the primordial, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's no love there.
It's beyond love, yes.
It's love.
Before love. Love is what comes out of...
consciousness.
Yes. Love is what comes out of that primordial void. It's an expression of it. But in and of itself, of course, it's quality-less. Right? The primordial void has no qualities, not even love.
Does anyone find that terrifying?
The question is does anyone not find it terrifying?
Okay, and then terror fills the space of awareness, and is that?
Yes.
Is this?
Yeah.
Okay, so
right.
How does one...
Wouldn't it be great if I could give you a great, concise little instruction manual for this, Patricia?
Yeah, okay.
Of course, when really one touches upon this sort of primordial void, it's very common that it elicits great anxiety, sometimes, of course, fear, and very often even terror.
3 years.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's not uncommon.
Working on 20.
Yeah. And really, ultimately, what it comes down to, what I've seen, what it comes down to is in the face of that fear,
yes,
of that fear of annihilation, because really it's what it is.
Yeah. You
know, you're confronting
really
annihilation.
Yeah.
Right. And it's completely unknown, right? So it's completely and absolutely unknown territory.
And it can't be known.
Right. That's the whole thing. It can't be known, and it can't be sought after. It can't even be wanted. It can't be anything.
And it's there all the time.
Right. And it's there all the time. So that's kind of what lurks in the essence of everyone.
And everything.
And everything.
Everywhere.
Yes. Yes.
Got it.
When your eyes start to really open, you can literally, you can intuit this primordial void in everything you look at.
Yes.
Yes. So there it's like you're living in it.
Yes.
And in that is sort of the very root sense of one's identity. And by root sense, now I'm not just talking about like egoic identity.
I know.
I'm talking about an identity that's much deeper than that. It's just sort of this irrational holding.
Yes.
That's really our root sense of self, is just a sort of irrational grasping. That's why when people kind of feel into their most rudimentary or existential sense of self, it's deeper than their mind, it's deeper than their emotions, it's that sort of clench in the gut, right?
Yeah.
And when you come upon this sort of primordial void, even the intuition of it, it'll often cause this kind of this terror in the gut.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the difficulty, of course, as a spiritual teacher is a lot of things you can kind of guide people through. This one is not quite that simple. This one requires something extraordinarily simple, Patricia. It requires, in the face of that fear, in the face of that intuition of a type of annihilation, all it requires is a yes. And the yes.
Why did I know you were?
It's totally irrational. There's no reason to say yes, is there?
Well, there's no conscious.
And you can't create this yes. That's why I say.
That's what I wanted to say.
Yes, that's it. Because that's why I say, as a teacher, this becomes more. At least I have. You can't give a nice, concise spiritual teaching about it because you can't create the kind of yes I'm talking about. You can't manufacture it.
Well, how exhausted does one have to get?
That's the question. It's different for everybody. How exhausted do you have to get?
If I had a vote, I would tell you.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is there's no such thing as how exhausted you need to get. There's no line of or amount of exhaustion or resistance that needs to become. It's just, see what I'm speaking about, Patricia, it's literally, it's already there. It's already, what I'm talking, this yes, it's already in you. It's like anything else, you just recognize it. Where you find it is right in the middle of the no. Right in the middle of I'm terrified. You know, I have this sort of just completely irrational terror that I will be, you know, completely destroyed, annihilated. Right in the middle of that, go into or stop is kind of the same thing in the context I'm talking about. If you were to kind of go really right into the middle of it, but then of your own fear, but then didn't stop anywhere along the way, because fear tends to make us kind of brace and stop, doesn't it? Hold back. But if you were to just completely go all the way in right into the middle of it, that's where that yes is. That's where the recognition is. Something just, for no reason, not even because you're tired or exhausted, you just realize, wow, there is a yes. And it's the simplest, quietest, smallest little yes there is. It's not, there's nothing courageous or big about it. It's just a sort of a fact that you just discover, oh, there's a yes to this. And so when that intuition of fear and non-existence comes up, that little thing in you is just kind of going, yes. So it's a matter of becoming conscious of it more than trying to make it, because it's something that you can never, ever, ever, ever make.
But it's there.
But it's there. It's there. Yeah. And sometimes for some people, I find when they begin to notice that there is that yes, that can scare them. Like, oh my God, there is a yes.
No.
You see, but
that would be fine.
Yeah, and then other people actually find it as a great relief. Like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, because it's like I said, it's not like there's a vote. So
right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I can feel that.
You can feel that?
Yeah.
Right, right. That's.
But
what?
There's still a but.
Yeah. What's the but?
Okay. Can I call back sometime about the same topic?
Sure, you can call back any time about the same topic.
Even to hear you say the same thing?
Of course. My goodness, I mean, most of us, you know, we hear the same thing 10, 20, 100 times, 500 times until it sinks in. So number of times is what is often what this is all about, right?
If all this has been seen,
yeah,
and then where's the clarity, the big love?
The big love?
Only after the yes?
Well, see,
you know what I mean. Not
I
love,
do.
Love.
I know what you. Yes, I know what you mean.
I can feel. That's truth for me.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. From the non-existence, you see, from the primordial void, finding that that's where the greatest embrace of the yes to life happens. And that embrace, that yes that comes from the void, that's the greatest love you ever find. That's the funny thing about this, because right in the middle of non-existence, you don't expect to find a yes or love.
Right.
But that's where it's birthed from.
And that's been the okay.
See, the problem is we keep looking for this love first.
Like, yeah, with the felt.
I could let go if there was a great big warm embrace waiting for me, but all I get is this great big cold infinite. Void that seems to want to annihilate me.
It was a shock.
Right, and I'm waiting for it to be warm and cozy. And all I can say is, you know, it gets warm and cozy once the annihilation's happened.
I don't care if it's cold and icy, as long as it's recognized as
yeah.
That there's yeah. No adjective.
Yeah.
That love.
Yeah. Yes, the love with no edges, that great and personal agape love.
Yeah.
The real agape love, which is a total unconditional love of what is.
As your prelude song says, when you become the song.
Yes. Yeah. You become the song. Yeah. That's it. That's it.
And it's there in that void.
It's there in the void. Everything's there. Because that is the... That's the point of Genesis. That's where everything arises from.
I know. Right? But I wasn't there, so I couldn't find it.
That's right.
So the ego and the philosophical, metaphysical brain assumed, uh-oh.
Okay. Right. Don't want to go there where I won't be when I get there.
Well, as long as the love's there, it's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know you surely have other callers.
Well, this is a great one to start with.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Thank you. And if nothing else, along with resting as awareness, I'll be waiting to feel these space that's not a space of the yes.
Great. And will you let me know?
And I'm going to trust you and hold you to it.
Okay.
Love in the nothingness.
Yes. Love is what arises out of the nothingness. Okay? The nothingness is beyond, in and of itself, it's the source, it's the genesis point for love and for everything else for that matter. But in and of itself, it's transcendent of every experience you could ever have. It's not any of those. But it's sort of its one of its first expressions is love. I mean, that's what creation is. Creation is...
Can it not have that first expression?
No.
Okay.
The nature of the void is to express itself.
I figured that out.
Always.
I mean, look around.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? Yeah, that's not like philosophical or theological. It's like, there it is. It's all around us. There's the inexpressible expression of the void, of that which is more nothing than even our greatest ideas of nothing could ever be. And the funny thing is, here you and I are right now, and everything that we're talking about is literally, it's already what we are. We actually are this primordial void expressing itself as consciousness and love
that. You know, there's this expression and that expression and the next expression.
Yes, yes, yes. That's part of the fun, too.
And you see it all as love, and I don't quite, so the ego's still there.
Yeah. Well, I would...
Well, I mean, of course it's there. It's
yeah.
an expression, too, but it's still a little too...
Yeah.
Dominant.
You see, at least for me, you know, it was the bottom line, Patricia. It was, I just had to know.
Yeah.
It was like, for me personally, when I got to this point, I didn't care what the ultimate reality was going to end up to be. Good, bad, horrible, neutral. I just had to know.
Yeah, I still care, but...
Yes.
I've got to know.
Yes, yes. It's not that you don't care, but it's just that inextricable, almost, you know, unexplainable.
What are we here for?
Yeah. Yeah.
It must be this.
What's really going on? What's it really all about? And you can't enter the deepest thing within. You can't enter the deepest place with any preconditions. Like, I'll let go if it's loving. Well, that's just enough precondition to where you'll just sort of stay outside of it and be really afraid. So you kind of enter it on its own terms.
Yeah.
And then
you
find out.
There is understanding here, honest.
Pardon me?
There is understanding here.
Yes, I know. I know. I know. There's just something that's completes itself when there is when there's total cooperation. When all the various levels of our self, of our identity, they all sort of just line up for a moment, and they're all in cooperation with what we've been speaking about. And that really makes all the difference.
I believe.
'Cause you know what I'm speaking about.
I do.
This is not what I'm speaking about is not outside of your experience. It's just that your knowing of it is moving in the direction of really completing itself, right? But you know this because you get those foretastes and those experiences and those intuitions, and you know it's all there for you, isn't it?
It's all there. It's just not seen, sensed with clarity.
Yeah, right.
But it's known.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me know how it goes, will you?
I will.
Give me a ring back.
Thank you so much. Oh,
great to talk with you. Thanks for calling in.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Okay, I am going to go to Uma in California. Welcome, Uma.
Hi.
Hi, did I get your name right?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Well, welcome. What'd you call for?
Thank you. What did I call for?
Yeah.
My question is, at the retreat last week, you were talking about how most of the spiritual practice that people do is actually putting them to sleep instead of waking them up.
Oftentimes it can do that, yeah.
And so my question is...
Including what I teach, people can use it to put themselves to sleep or to wake themselves up, you know,
right.
Either way.
So I was wondering if you could talk about that. And for myself, I wonder how I can tell which one I'm doing and mm-hmm. if there's any, you know, obvious road map signs or... You just say something more about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it all comes back to your... This comes back to your sincerity. You know, if we really want to know what's really real, if we really want to know what we really are and what's really, really real here, what's really going on, that's all that's necessary. If that's what you really want to know, if that's what's really in your heart, I mean, that you may not state it in exactly the way I just stated it, but if somewhere that's really what it's all about, then everything will serve you, actually. You know, and if you have another agenda, which it could be, you know, every human being just wants to feel good, don't they?
Right.
I mean, given the choice, most anybody that's rational would choose to feel better than worse. But it's very easy for this sort of desire to feel good to completely hijack your whole spiritual process, and your whole spiritual process becomes about... How can I use each and every teaching from whoever the teacher is, whatever the tradition is, how can I use it to make myself feel better? And that's not bad, and that's not even wrong, but if that's our highest goal is to feel better, although everybody wants to feel better, and that's fine, but if that becomes our highest intention, our highest goal, then it's going to limit us.
So are you saying that, let's say I'm doing a practice that happens to... bring about feelings of joy and peace and equanimity and bliss and all that. So that could either be, it depends what my intention is, whether that feeling of peace is just a feeling better type of feeling that's gonna dead end me or not.
Yeah. It's not, like I said, it's not bad that you feel peace or happy or, you know, really, really open. That's wonderful. But you know, again, everything literally does it all. It follows your intention. That's what it follows. What's really in your heart. That's what I mean by sincerity. What's really, really in your heart. That's what you'll end up with. It really is. So there's not really a technique to this as much as just recognizing that what's really in your heart, what you really, really want, is really what you end up with. You see? So let's just imagine someone. Is, you know, they're meditating or doing some practice and they come to me and they go, Ajay, I feel so much bliss and love and joy and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I go, wonderful, you know, I'm glad you're having this wonderful positive experience. Now, can you tell me what you are? Well, no, I don't care what I am. I cared what I was yesterday, but you see, now that I'm experiencing all this bliss and love and openness, I don't care anymore. Now, see, for that person... If that's all they want, that's what they'll get. And I'm not even saying it's wrong, but I'm just saying that if all someone wanted was to feel really, really, really great, you know, you can do spiritual practices that temporarily can make you feel extraordinarily good.
It's like medication.
Yeah, you can, exactly. You, like anything else in life, you can use spirituality as medication or as something to open your eyes up, right? So that's, you know, I love the word you used was wonderful. Yeah, you can use it to medicate yourself or you can use it to help yourself wake up. And I wouldn't worry about it. I really wouldn't, you know, worry about this as much. All I really say that, the only reason I say, you know, that everything follows your sincerity is, number one, because it generally does. And number two, sometimes it just causes people just to reflect enough to just kind of go, hey, what's my yearning really, really for? And I find when people even really ask themselves that question, often what they yearn for is something even deeper than they were really conscious of or aware of. And it just kind of connects you back with your sincerity.
So there's not a danger in itself of doing a practice that makes you feel peaceful.
No. No. Mm-mm. There's not a danger in and of itself to do that. No. In other words, it's not going to hijack your spiritual awakening unless that's the only thing you're in it for. Mm.
One thing that happens to me a lot tends to be that I will do something that will get me, I'll reach, and it goes in cycles, and I'll reach an experience of feeling really peaceful or equanimous or something, and then it's usually followed pretty quickly by getting really arrogant and insensitive, and, you know, then the crash.
Then the crash, yes.
So I didn't know if that was a sign that I was putting myself to sleep with the practice or if that's just normal cycle.
Well, I put it this way. If you had successfully put yourself to sleep with the practice, you wouldn't be calling me. Right? We wouldn't be having this discussion.
Well, the arrogance is pretty painful, you know.
Of course it's pretty painful. But, I mean, if you were only in it to feel better... Yeah, I don't think you'd be calling me up and talking to me about it. But I think a lot of people that are probably listening can, you know, have had a similar experience. You can have, you know, if you do certain spiritual techniques or practices, sometimes you can run into really, really great states. And when you run into a great state, your mind or your ego often makes an assumption. Hey, I have gotten somewhere.
Yeah.
I've achieved something. And then with that, you know, kind of innocent conclusion, the arrogance begins, you know?
Even now, since it's happened to me like a zillion times, now I'm really trying to be vigilant on the lookout for it. Like, okay, where's my arrogance? Where's it coming?
Yeah.
And it still gets me, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, that's why I would just sort of reorient the trajectory, the way you approach it. And I mean, because you can also get sort of hyper vigilant about arrogance and about all these, you know, states that you don't think you're supposed to have or you don't want to have. You can do that, but really in the end, what I'm talking about comes out of a very simple observation that you've already had, and you can make anytime you want, that any and every experience you have comes and goes, does it not?
Mm-hmm.
It all comes, it all goes. And sort of spirit, quote, spiritual experiences are not immune from the law of impermanence. They also come and they also go. And that's just the way that experience is. It comes and it goes. Now, when you have a bad experience, you're glad that there is, you know, the law of impermanence. You're glad that you kind of say, this will not last forever, this will go. But when it's really pleasant, most people want to hold on to it. But nonetheless, all experiences come, all experiences go. When you see that, you realize you have an opportunity now. You can either continue to chase experiences or sustaining certain good experiences, or you can realize, hey, that's a losing game. You can't sustain something by its very nature is impermanent. And anyway, it doesn't tell me anything about who it is that's having this experience. There's something more fundamental than whatever experience I'm having. And the thing that's always more fundamental is me. Do you see? Is the you who's having the experience. And then the you who's losing the experience. And the you who gets, you know, arrogant. And then the you who's humbled by the arrogance. And see, all this sort of play can happen, and we remain completely oblivious to who this thing we call ourselves actually is. And really, what spirituality really is coming to a direct experiential realization of who and what you really are, who and what actually has these experiences. You see, that's a different orientation to one's spiritual life. You're like, oh, I'm no longer asking, how can I have this experience, or how can I have more awareness, or how can I have anything? And I've gone to a little bit deeper place and looked at, hey, who is it that's having these experiences? Who is it that's trying to have them, or getting arrogant, or getting humbled, or who is this person that I call me that's always in the center of everything, or seems to be? And see, that kind of question leads you very quickly to the unknown, right? Your mind, you know, you realize that you really don't know. And then there's a stopping there. There's an invitation to stop right there. Don't create some false knowing in your mind, but you really stop. You stop and you begin to experience the mystery that you are. You see, and that in itself takes you outside the boundaries of experience into what all experience is happening within. You follow me?
Well, as much as I can. You don't think that there's, like, some systems of teaching kind of guide you that you have to kind of let go of your gross level of tension and anxiety to even understand that. So
yeah,
that's
well,
where
that's
I look
just
to those states of, oh yay, I'm feeling peaceful. You know,
right.
I was feeling anxious.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not true. It's just simply not true. I've seen people that are just, you know, anxious, you know, sort of semi-emotional wrecks, and they can awaken right out of it. They can awaken. It's these. See, what often happens is in spirituality is we mistake the natural byproduct of the awakened state for the road to the awakened state.
Yeah, and that's where I'm looking at.
And and one doesn't have to do with the other. In other words, when awakening really happens, this shift of consciousness, naturally, what we really are isn't attached. It's not grabbing at this. It's not pushing that away. It's not doing that because it should or shouldn't. It's just consciousness in its essence is not something that grasps and pushes away. It's non-attached, in other words. But what happens is that's a byproduct. Non-attachment is a byproduct of knowing what you are. But what it gets mistaken as, oh, then I, as an ego, will try to practice non-attachment, and that'll get me there.
Or tranquility.
Right, or any of that stuff. But you see, to be disturbed, to not be tranquil, is actually, and I don't mean you should go about trying to create, you know, unpleasant states, but often what arouses consciousness into awakening is when we're actually willing to be disturbed, we're willing to go, wait a minute, you know, the way that I'm perceiving things, this can't be real. You know, in other words, it's sort of a divine discontent. Do you know what I mean? And a lot of times people are using, unknowingly, they're using their spiritual practices to soothe their feeling of this sort of divine discontent.
That's what I was talking about. How do I tell if I'm doing that? Yeah. Exactly.
It all comes back to your motivation. That's always comes back to your motivation. Do you see? And please, for you and for anybody else, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that, you know, anybody's motivation is wrong, or one should do it this way or should be interested in that. And I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that number one, often, not always, but often, where we end up follows our sincerity. What we really, 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 when push comes to shove, what we really want more than anything else. And that this feeling of discontent is a very strong motivator to awaken. And it's something that we often try to medicate so we don't feel, you know, whether people are taking drugs or drinking too much Or sometimes people are meditating to cover over this discontent. And discontent is part and parcel of the dream state. It actually is a thing that helps you wake up from it. As the Buddha said, right, like this in this life and in the life that people are living in the dream state, suffering, or what he called unsatisfactoriness, is part of it. And you either utilize unsatisfactoriness to help you really awaken, or you're just trying to tranquilize yourself so you don't feel as much as that unsatisfactoriness. And so we can use our spirituality and everything else in life for that matter, but we can use our spirituality either way. Either we're really addressing that divine discontent head on, or we're using spirituality or anything else as a way of not feeling that divine discontent, not addressing it. So I know, I understand your kind of question. I really get it. Like, how do I know which one I'm doing and, you know, all that kind of thing? And how do I know if I'm, you know, if I have the right sincerity, the wrong sincerity, or all that kind of stuff? I really get that.
Yeah.
That's why I keep trying to take this to sort of a simple place, which is it always comes down to the same thing. What do you want? Do you really want to know what's real and true? If you do, you're probably going to end up with it. And if you don't, chances are you probably won't, although that's not always the case either. But if you really want to know what's real and true, what's really real, then, you see, then that's, as I say, that will guide you. And if you really don't want to know what's true, if pretty much all you want to do is basically feel better whether you know what's true or not, then that may be what you end up with. You may end up with feeling better. And if that's all somebody wants, like I say, that's perfectly okay.
But maybe it's a blessing that it never lasts.
Yes. That's right. Impermanence is a blessing because eventually it forces everything and everybody to wake up. It's a harsh, fierce grace. You know, it's just the package it comes in. It's just the way it is. Yeah, eventually it catches up. It really does. Because eventually what we find out is all the things we do to just make ourselves feel better, they some of them work, but they work temporarily and we're right back where we started.
Yeah.
We're back like, I don't know who I am. I don't know what life is. I don't know what God is. I don't know if this existence has meaning or not. I don't know what enlightenment, I don't know any, that's where we back end up back again. And of course, that's where the real dilemma of existence lies. That is the dilemma of existence. That's the existential dilemma of existence.
Well, I don't seem to end up quite right back where I started. I seem to end up each time more sensitive to
well, that's a good thing.
To all the effects of my ego, I guess, arrogance and...
Well, good.
Whatever, but it's more painful.
Well, yeah, becoming more conscious isn't necessarily feel great all the time. Right? In other words, it's not real. It's not like all fun to find out how, you know, that you have this hidden arrogance that comes out now and then.
No.
That's not like something you go, wow, I'm really glad I found that out. It makes me feel great. Right?
That's kind of embarrassing.
Right. It's kind of embarrassing also. Yeah, but then, again, everything really serves when you want it to serve, when you go, oh, gosh, that's there. Oh, that's a part of myself that's a little bit embarrassing, right? And that can become a doorway. Okay. Your ego can act, you know, either arrogant or the next day it might act very humble. But that's your ego acting one way or the other. That's the appearance of you. Is that all there is to you? Do you see? And that's the deeper thing. So I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you so
much. It's been really, really nice to talk with you, and I think you raised this question really, I imagine, resonates for a lot of people listening too. So I know you asked it for yourself, but I think unknowingly or without your intention, you probably asked it for a whole lot of other people, because I think this is really, 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 really common, and yet it's really such a, it's the essence of, you know, of spirituality. So I ask people all the time, I say, gosh, I meet people who've been at spirituality for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And they don't often, when I say, what is it that you really want? What is this really about for you? I often find that even people that have put in many years and lots of effort, that they're often not really totally clear on what it is for them. Maybe they've let some other guru define what it should be, or a book, or something other than themselves. But to really find out what it's all about for you is, that's the most important thing, actually. And it's funny because it's like the last thing a lot of people get around to. Do you know? It really, really is. And even if what you want to do is to feel better, in the end, what you realize is there's really no permanent happiness without realizing who you are. There's really no way to it. So thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
I like talking with you. All right. Bye-bye, Uma.
Bye.
Okay, I think I'm going to go to someone calling from India. Is it Nicole?
Yes, it's Nicole calling from Tiruvannamalai.
Nicole, so nice to hear your voice. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hello, Anya.
Hi.
Nice to hear you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, can you?
I can hear you wonderfully. What did you want to talk with me about?
Yeah. Like, I have a question about the natural state.
Yeah.
So, to make it very short and simple, the question would be how to keep the natural state.
How to keep the natural state.
Keep the natural state, yeah.
Well, that's...
And I wanna explain just a little bit what I experience around here right now.
Yeah.
The surrender goes on a very, like, energetical level. So it has nothing to do with my mind somehow anymore, yeah?
Yes, yes.
And I recognize when I go to the Samadhi of Ramana Maharshi here that there happens a surrender on a much deeper level than my mind could kind of go.
Yes.
And it's there when I'm influenced by the energy there, mm-hmm. but when I leave the place, it kind of runs a little bit further, yeah, sometimes a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of leaves me and I get a lot of pain in the body, a lot of burning sensations, mainly in the chakras or in the meridians, in the hands, in the feet. And I start to suffer on a quite, on a very fine level, which is not a mental suffering anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to know if you can say something and what I could do to help this process.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate and love the term that you use, the natural state, because that's really what this is really all about, is rediscovering our natural state. And there you are and Tiruvannamalai and in the place where Ramana spent the vast majority of his life and certainly all of his adult life. And I haven't been there, but I know there's a great presence and a transmission to the mountain that's still available to people. And that energetic transmission is of course what you experience when you're there. And of course you can experience elsewhere, but it also sort of aligns you with that natural state within your own being. And one thing that's very, very important to to have a real sense of is that what's happening when you're there and you're in stillness and it's taking you to a very, very deep place is to know that it's your whole system is responding to that environment. But essentially what it's doing is you're discovering that that same state, to use your word, that same natural state is being, how can we say, it's being highlighted within you. So in other words, you're experiencing your natural state. Being at the mountain just helps you to touch in with it, you know, energetically, at a level that's much, much deeper than your mind. And so it sounds like what you're doing, of course, then you leave that environment, right? Then you leave that place of great transmission, and then you're with your own self, aren't you?
Yeah, and it seems like it's nothing I can do, because
yes,
it's nothing I can influence on that deep level,
right,
in the body. And
you can't create it. Right.
Yeah?
Yes, I understand. Yeah, I know there's nothing you can do and you can't create it. But one of the things is having the willingness to really pay very, very close attention, and now I'm speaking almost energetically, to that same presence. And when you leave the mountain, it may not be as strong. It may actually start as a very fine and subtle thread of that presence of the natural state. But if you can sort of really feel into it, even when you're away from the mountain, because then when you really feel into it, even if it's slight, even if it's very, very subtle, by just feeling into it and seeing if it's still there, by putting your attention on it, then it grows.
Mm.
You see, but it's very common for people to come into powerful environments, whether it's like, you know, Theravalamanai, the mountain, certain, you know, you come to a certain spiritual teacher and they can have a certain presence and that helps align you with that presence. And then, of course, you know, the very, very common thing that all spiritual teachers, I think, get asked a lot is when I'm outside of the presence of that person or that environment or that mountain or whatever it may be, then it's not as, you know, then it tends to dissipate. And that's really understandable, but that's now, that itself is an invitation now to start paying even closer attention to that same presence in yourself that will feel diminished, won't be as overpowering when you leave the environment. But yet now your responsibility becomes to pay attention to whatever there is of that natural state within you, to really pay attention to it, to not expect it to be as big or as strong or as powerful, but to start to notice that it's always there as this sort of undercurrent. You see? Like Ramana said, you know, let what comes come, let what goes go, find out what remains. And so when you go away from this powerful location, now what you're being asked to do is to pay really close attention to this much finer and subtler thread of the natural state and not expect it to be as big or as powerful or as, you know, not expect it to sort of just do it for you. Do you know? Because that's what happens when you get in those very powerful environments. It sort of does all this for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it also left me a bit disappointed because I go away and I get this strong pain in the body, not really knowing what it is. Is it the discouragement or is it just the pain of getting out of this wonderful relaxation that comes?
Well, it sounds to me that what comes with this kind of experience and certainly these kind of realizations is, you know, you do sort of open up a lot of energy in your system, right? Often called kundalini energy, and it's something that a lot of people think they want to happen. But when it does happen, when it starts to get going, it is something that it's going to probably take your body quite some time to adapt to. Because yeah. your body is not used to this much influx of energy. And it's literally not used to handling this. And it can literally kind of, sometimes it kind of blows out some of your circuits. You can kind of feel really exhausted at times, or sometimes it can just feel overwhelming. It can feel very, very painful if they're in certain areas of your body that it may be blocked. And yet, what I think what I want to communicate to you is number one, don't expect your body to adapt to it overnight, because it very rarely does, very rarely. And it's not wrong. It's not an indication that anything's gone wrong that you feel these sort of certain pains or certain movements of powerful energy that might not even be really comfortable. That doesn't mean anything's gone wrong. It just means that that kind of energy has become, is really sort of, that's part of what wakes up, is that very, very powerful energy current, and your body's adapting to it, and it will take some time. And the more you're sort of easy around it, the more you just have a lot of spaciousness around it and aren't trying to force anything to happen, it makes it easier for your system to adapt to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you're... pardon me?
Yeah. So what I understand is, like, to become conscious on a even cellular
yes.
level, to relax on a cellular level to this very, very fine energy, which is available there in the natural state, or which is flowing there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because you, like I said, you go to certain teachers, you go to certain environments, and it'll kind of wake that up in you. And then you go away from it, and then your part will be, you can't recreate it, you can't make it happen. But what I'm talking about is something very different than trying to make it happen. It's you start to, you attend in a very subtle way to that presence that is there, even though it's not as big and as all-encompassing. And when you do start to pay attention to that and not ask it to be bigger than it is, just the attention itself is sort of, it allows that natural state to even grow in your consciousness more and more and more. And it's why a lot of people miss it, because they have these really powerful experiences and they keep looking for something equally as powerful all the time. Mm-hmm. And while they're doing that, they miss that the same thing is there, but it's just in this sort of subtle undercurrent.
You know?
And when you start to pay attention to it, you'll be amazed.
I can see this very clearly in the natural state. But then there is when the pain comes, then it's also very easy to kind of fall out again, and to get angry, and then it's kind of lost. And then there is the knowing of it always there.
Yeah, I know.
Because I experienced it that way, but I can't see it like that in this actual moment anymore, and I don't get the access, and then it becomes more and more difficult to connect again.
Right, I know. And then you feel the loss of it even more because you've known it, right?
Yeah.
I understand when there's, you know, when there's a lot of pain, that it's not as easy, because what we tend to do is, when we feel physical pain, we tend to contract around it. Not only physically contract, but also emotionally contract, psychologically. We tend to contract, and we're, in many ways, we're almost taught that that's what we need to do. So I want to just leave you with a question, which, when you feel that happening, is to just very quietly just ask yourself, your whole system, is it really necessary to contract in this pain? Is it really necessary? Does that need to happen? And then just be still and let the question do its work. Because your system, it's had a lifetime of absorbing conditioning, which says when you feel uncomfortable, when you're in a lot of pain, you have to contract. It's totally natural. And what I'm doing is, you're questioning that. You're not only questioning it in your mind, but you're helping your body to question its very unconscious kind of conditioning, you see?
Yeah.
And it can really, really help just asking your system, your body, your energetic system, is it necessary to contract in the face of this kind of pain? I really know because I have, you know, fortunately everything's quite good now, but over the last 4 years, you know, I've had moments where I've had a lot of physical pain. And so I very much... Oh, yes. I've been in the hospital any number of times in the last 4 years with amazing pain that no painkiller they ever give me even touches it. And so I really know what you're talking about from experience, and I do know the how subtle this is and how much of it's sort of a, you know, it's another fierce grace, right? It's another... To pay attention and to really question, is it really necessary to contract physically around pain? Is it necessary to contract emotionally? And your system realizes it's not necessary. And that really helps your system to come back into alignment again. So just kind of play,
very,
you know.
Very good to hear, yeah.
Yeah, kind of play with it a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the funny thing is that suddenly it completely disappears and I'm fully at ease in the mind, in the body, and it seems to flow very harmonious, the energy, and then suddenly it changes and there is no cost visible so far. Yeah.
Right. Doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason about it, does there?
Yeah.
Another way to look at this is just to see it from the natural state. In other words, just ask yourself, does the natural state resist pain? And so you start to look at it and experience it and feel it from the natural state just by asking the question, does this this natural state, how does it resist pain? Does it resist discomfort, you see? Because then you, as an ego, you're not trying to do anything then. You notice? The only thing you're doing is kind of asking questions and allowing your whole being to come into a different relationship.
Great.
All right. Well, I hope the very best for you.
Yeah, thank you.
There
is one more question.
Okay.
We'd like to ask.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it seems like a very much a pure Vanamalai question.
Okay.
Because from this Advaita teachers we have here, we have all the people running around, and there is this famous question, who am I?
Yeah.
And then the mind goes, nobody, or I don't know.
Yeah.
There comes no answer from the mind.
Yeah.
And then people run around and everybody tells you there is nobody here.
It's
not about me. And
I know.
My experience is there is somebody and there isn't somebody on the same time.
Yes.
And
to
come from just one side and say, oh, it doesn't happen to me. It has nothing to do with me. And it's kind of not the full truth. And I just wanted to ask you if you can say a little bit about it, because I see so many people get trapped from the answer that comes from the mind, from this, I don't know, and there is nobody.
I know. I'm very glad you brought this up, and I think what you've noticed is absolutely true. I've noticed it myself here in the States, and You know the sort of teachings that come from the Advaita tradition. They're very, very powerful teachings. They're very great pointers. But the problem is the more powerful a teaching is, the more easy it is to misuse it and misunderstand it. And what happens is a lot of these teachings, as we say in Zen, that the finger pointing to the moon has got mistaken for the moon. So the truth isn't something that you and I could put into words, is it? It's really not.
Yeah.
Like you said, when you stay with your experience, it's true non-duality is there is nobody here and there is somebody here. And it's like the truth is both of those are true and neither of them are true. And That when we're in our actual experience, not just in our head, when we're in experience, we come to know these things. We come to know where the teachings are pointing towards, and we don't get stuck with the teaching itself. You know, there is no doer, there is no this, there is. You know, if, like you said, if it gets stuck on the mental level, then it's just become sort of a spiritual game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why I caution people all the time, if you're going to use a teaching, you really have to go to what it's pointing toward and not get stuck on simply what the teaching says. Mm-hmm. It's like telling somebody how an orange tastes is not the same as tasting it yourself, is it? In fact, telling somebody how an orange tastes is nothing at all like an orange actually tastes when you taste it. The taste of it is completely, you could never describe it in 1,000 years, could you? So if we can't even explain what an orange tastes like, how on earth could we possibly explain what the ultimate is like?
Yeah.
We can't. But of course, people hear the teachings and they follow them to a limited degree. They follow them in their minds, and then they stop. And that's just the way things are. You know, that tends to happen. But when you've had some taste of the truth, then you know the difference between settling for an intellectual description of reality and really finding the living presence of it within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Two totally different things. So I'm really glad you mentioned that too, because I think it's very, very important to never be satisfied with just the content of a teaching, the pointers, or even what the teaching says, because it's at best, it's a finger pointing towards the moon. It's saying, go that direction. Don't get stuck on the pointer.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, you're very, very welcome. The time comes, I think, when the best spiritual practice is just you get done with the teachings and even the pointers, and the time comes when just stop and just be still and just let the rest happen from there. That's it.
Yeah.
Just stop. I mean, really, that was Ramana's greatest teaching. It was just stop, be still, and let the rest happen.
Yeah, I can feel that all the concepts and the finger pointers, and I can't read any books anymore.
Yes.
The teaching is the very moment. Yeah.
Yes. I've experienced the same thing myself. I've spoke with any number of people that when the teachings really start to deliver you where they're meant to deliver you, you don't even really have a taste for teachings anymore. You don't want to read about it. You want to actually be it.
Yeah.
That's very, very natural. Totally natural. It's like, you know, it's the difference between eating a good meal and eating the menu. You know, once you've had a good meal, you don't need to keep ingesting the menu, do you? You know, it's the reality. So I want to thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, I want to thank you also very much.
You're very welcome.
And somehow it came to my mind, I just want to mention it. Sometimes I had the feeling it would be wonderful to have you here one day if you were one of my lives. So.
Right, you never know. You never know. You never know. I do feel a certain.
I had the organization and come to Vanamalai in 5 years. So.
Mm.
Just to mention.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Adya Santi.
You're welcome. Bye bye. Namaste.
Bye bye. Bye. Namaste.
Okay. Well, I know I have a couple of callers on the line, but we are a little late in the program, so I apologize for those who are connected. Please call back. Next time I have a program, I'd love to talk with you. Anybody for that matter, but especially the two people that I didn't get to on the lines. The calls I took longer than usual, but they were so rich and so deep that I think they really deserved a lot of attention, which really ultimately everything does. I want to remind everybody that some upcoming events here in California. This Saturday, I'm going to be doing a Christmas intensive in Palo Alto. And then on January 16th, my wife Mukti is going to be doing a silent one-day retreat in Palo Alto. And on the 22nd to the 24th, I'll be doing a long weekend retreat, the 22nd to the 24th in Mount Madonna. So that's what's upcoming, but I want to also invite everyone to not wait for anything, not wait for the next program or the next book or the next event or anything, but really, really look into the nature of your own being now. Just be still, just be quiet, and listen with the entirety of your being. Nothing needs to happen to do that. And ultimately, that's what this program is for. That's what these teachings are for, are just ways in which to help you to listen and to realize what you are and what all this around us really truly is, to return to our origin and our source. So thank you so much for tuning in to the program this evening. And the next live broadcast will be the 13th of January in 2010. I wish everyone a very, very happy new year, and I hope you bring to yourself and find within yourself all the peace and the happiness and freedom that you're looking for. Namaste.